Paul Sachs. I'm editor-in-chief of Clinical Infectious Diseases, and welcome to the Let's Talk ID podcast. Joining me today is Dr. Elizabeth Homan, who's an ID specialist at Massachusetts General Hospital, where she's the director of the Fecal Microbiota Transplant Lab and runs the C. diff treatment program there. She's also an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and, trivia for you, was a co-fellow with me a million years ago. Libby, welcome.
Great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about you. Tell us about how you got into medicine in general and to ID in particular.
Well, I always liked science and I like practical science, so I decided to go to medical school. And my favorite class in my entire medical school career was microbiology. I really thought it was fascinating. I love the classic plagues of mankind, all the old diseases, and the fact that we continue to have new diseases. So that's how I ended up in ID.
And did you have any role models, physicians or other people who might stand out for you that made you go into medicine or go into ID?
Well, actually, that professor in medical school, he wrote his own textbook for the medical students, which was a little kind of home published thing. And he was a role model and really interesting guy.
Great. Great. Well, you know, I invited you on because you are a specialist in an area of ID that I think many of us really struggle with. And that is something I'm going to call microbiome-related therapy. It's not antibacterials. It's not antivirals. It's not antifungals. But it's this whole new way of treating some infectious diseases. And before we get into it, I want you to help me out with the terminology. How would you explain the difference between things called prebiotics, probiotics, synbiotics? Our patients are using these terms now, and frankly, I have no idea what they're talking about.
Yeah, I find most doctors don't really understand this, and it's pretty complicated. So I think we all know what probiotics are. They're live bacteria that are intended to, you know, benefit our health or well-being in some way. So that's a probiotic. A prebiotic is actually typically a carbohydrate source or other food source for those probiotics that enhances their ability to act or survive, or makes the particularly intestinal milieu something more friendly towards the good bacteria that we want to keep. Synbiotics are a combination of a prebiotic and a probiotic. So sort of feeding the probiotic, giving it the right stuff to survive. There's also something called postbiotics, which are compounds that are beneficial or make a good environment that are produced by these either probiotics or by natural organisms. So those are sort of chemicals, and those, in fact, can be given on their own to try to maintain a better environment for bacteria.
It really is fascinating. I have to say, when you walk into a health food store, or a grocery store, you can buy these. How do you choose? I mean, we'll get into that momentarily. But I want to also just say that you've joked to me that the GI docs think of you as an honorary gastroenterologist. And why is that?
Just because I'm one of the few ID specialists that actually has a big fecal transplant program and has been involved in the development of these live bacterial products, as the FDA sometimes calls these sorts of therapeutics. Just by whatever misfortune, I ended up studying GI infections. I mean, as you know, some of my other expertise is in Salmonella and Listeria, which has an intestinal phase. And so I do kind of have an affinity for the gastroenterologist. I meet them a lot at meetings. I've gone to some of their meetings, and I think they're a fun group.
How do they compare to ID doctors?
They're kind of very practical people. They get to the point. They like to do procedures. They don't like to fuss around with things. They just like to cut to the chase. And it's fun to go out to dinner with a group of gastroenterologists.
So they're not ones to spend 15 minutes going through the differential diagnosis that names every microorganism in Mandel.
Not even close.
Okay. So I have to say, a lot of us are skeptical about probiotics and related therapies because they are completely unregulated. Your thoughts about the limitations of studies so far, most of them at least, that have come out?
Well, this is one of the problems with the studies. Most people don't know there's actually now, by this time, last I looked, it was 90, but it was probably 100 different probiotics that you can purchase in the United States. They're not sold as drugs. They're sold under wellness claims. They're very variable. It's like going to the store and buying a cup of yogurt. That's sort of the level of oversight of them. It's basically the food side of the FDA, not the drug side. And the standards are completely different.
So you mean that a person can't just take one off the shelf and assume it's going to work for them?
No, you can't assume anything about taking it off the shelf. You can't really understand how many live bacteria are in there. You can't assume that what they tell you is in there probably is in there. It's like buying a stalk of asparagus, or it's probably less accurate than buying a stalk of asparagus because you can at least look at the asparagus and know, I think that looks like an asparagus.
That's right. That's right. You know, you could actually do when you're checking out at the grocery store now, they can do an image search for you on some of these scanners and that, you know, it's an asparagus. You can't do that with bacteria. So I'm going to ask you, if you're a company and you're in the probiotic business, which would be a faster route, going the supplement route or going the FDA-approved therapy route? I know the answer, but you tell me.
It's like the difference between a sprint and an ultra marathon. You can market a probiotic with some very basic oversight of production, and you make a wellness claim, you know, this is going to help your GI health, something as nebulous as that. And you're off to the races and you're selling it. And as you know, to get a claim for, you know, microbial restoration after recurrent C. diff, it's taken Seres Therapeutics, which is across the river here in the Boston area, a decade to get their live microbiome therapeutic through the FDA process as a drug.
Well, you know, that brings us to my next question, which is related to C. diff. This is one area where ID doctors might know a little bit about it, although not nearly as much as you. Catch us up with what we can do sort of microbiome-wise for treatment and prevention of C. diff. I know there are a bunch of things. Give me a short list.
Well, in 2023, we have two new approved microbiome therapeutics. The first approved is called Rebiota, and that's basically an enema preparation for prevention of C. difficile colitis. It's frozen. It can be administered by a nurse or a doctor, and it's been approved for almost a year now for recurrent C. diff. Clearly for us infectious disease doctors, enemas in clinic is not a happy thing. I've never done it. I never will do it. Some gastroenterologists are able to do it either by enema, and some are also using it as a colonoscopic administration, although that is not on the label. That's the first of the recently approved drugs. The second one is called VAUST, and I kind of have to use the trade name because there really is no generic name. It's got some letters and then says microbial spores, and that is a microbiome therapeutic. It's 12 capsules over 4 days. And it is, too, is derived from human stool specimens, and it's given to prevent recurrence of C. difficile colitis.
And how do these play into a program where you might have FMT to prevent recurrent C. diff, or you might have bezlotoxumab to prevent recurrent C. diff? So how do we strategize?
Well, you know, this varies by doctor preference and patient preference and what you have available to you and what the patient has available to them. These newer approved live bacterial products are quite expensive, as I've already alluded to, there's different kinds of administration. Different patients may have a preference for one or other of them. I personally like microbial restoration to treat recurrent C. diff because I think it, for a couple of reasons, it fixes one of the primary underlying problems, which is a disturbed microbiome, and because patients feel better after getting these therapies, which in my experience is not really true of bezlotoxamine.
Well, that's very interesting. And what about, you know, sort of the homegrown FMT programs, since you were a pioneer in developing one?
Well, homegrown, you mean hospital grown, or, you know, there is patient homegrown as well, which, of course,
true,
we speak highly against because of the lack of any screening for infectious agents. And I do have a New England Journal CPC where I discuss a case of a patient who may have given themselves CMV colitis from their child who was in daycare's stool. Real homegrown is kind of off the table and somewhat dangerous.
Yeah, good reminder. It's all over YouTube, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So my mistake saying homegrown, I'm talking about hospital grown or ID clinic grown.
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing this for over a decade now. And if you're going to do this and provide fecally derived materials to particularly outside clinicians, outside of your immediate group, you do need to have an IND. You need to submit it to the FDA. You need to get their approval for all of the screening of the donor, the stool samples and whatnot. So it's quite an arduous task, not something that most people are willing to undertake, especially now that we do have these approved products, which are coming into clinical use.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, having recently seen a person with recurrent C. diff, I was faced with a whole new array of options, actually. And when discussing it with her, interestingly, the one that she favored the most was bezlotoxamab. But perhaps this issue of feeling better quickly and restoration of the microbiome is not one that she or I understood as clearly.
I never use that one first. That's a fallback for me, with the exception of people who are really freaked out by fecal transplant.
That's it exactly.
Or the other instance in which that's a better choice, I think, cancer patients who are immunosuppressed, where you might want to avoid any of the infectious risks of fecal transplant, or people who have B-cell depleting therapies like rituximab, where you might be repleting, you know, the antibody response that they're missing.
Yeah, very, very helpful perspective. So shifting now to a different area entirely, I couldn't help but notice a randomized clinical trial in everyone's least favorite disease, which is COVID-19, and in particular, one of the hardest things about COVID-19, which is long COVID. And Lancet ID recently published a paper called Symbiotic Preparation, SIM-01, for Post-Acute COVID-19 Syndrome in Hong Kong, the recovery trial. And it demonstrated a significant improvement in long COVID symptoms with the use of this microbiome-related therapy. I just ask you, Libby, do you believe it?
I do believe it.
Wow.
You know, I have a lot of skepticism for probiotic studies, but things that are double-blind, placebo-controlled are important and worth doing, and there is a biological reason why it's possible.
You know, obviously, this is a fascinating topic because these post-infectious fatigue syndromes have been so intractable for treatments. Why might a microbiome related treatment work in this condition?
I'm not an immunologist, but so much of the immune system resides in the gut, and the tissues around the gut, the lymphatic system, the intraepithelial cells, it's a huge part of the immune system, and we evolved with the microbes that are in the gut. I think this is one of the most exciting areas of medicine, showing how the microbiome, what you put in your gut can make a difference in your immune response, how you feel, how your brain works, the whole gut-brain axis. It's just a fascinating area of medicine, and it affects how it affects the regulatory status of your immune system. I recently, just yesterday, somebody sent me a paper that showed differing immune signatures, again, in a reputable, a very good journal, between a vegan diet and a keto diet, which are kind of on the extremes of the dietary spectrum that we have. But, you know, I think I believe these things. I have very high standards for belief, but I do believe them.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you're longstanding head of the Mass General Brigham IRB, so you certainly have seen your share of clinical trials. This leads me to another question I have, which is that there have been other COVID-19 studies that I know have caught your eye.
You mean with respect to the microbiome?
Yes, microbiome-related treatments.
Well, there was one out of a company in the Boston area called Kaleida, which actually went under recently, but they too had an intestinal therapy that was designed to modulate the immune system peri-COVID and post-COVID. Their intervention was a prebiotic, a specific set of oligosaccharides, again, directed at influencing the gut microbes and the responding cells. There's also a study that, a long ago study, that showed you could affect the quality and quantity of the immune response of older people receiving flu vaccine, injectable flu vaccine, by giving them a probiotic. There's lots of really good data. They're not huge effects, but these are simple interventions that are, for the most part, safe.
Great, great. Well, you know, with the caveat that, of course, I'm biased by mentioning this, we did recently publish in CID a study that looked at prophylactic oral and or vaginal probiotic supplementation to prevent recurrent urinary tract infections. And it brings up a whole other area of potential use of this treatment. Any thoughts about this particular strategy?
Yes. Again, I think these are viable strategies. When you can demonstrate, as that study did, that there was an incremental improvement in patients who got vaginal probiotics plus oral probiotics, I think these are valuable studies. They're not as effective as, say, FMT in somebody with a completely bombed out microbiome, but they can make a difference, and I think patients are really interested in them.
IDSA Academy makes it easy to stay up to date on your continuing education credits and offers learning opportunities all year round. With a variety of maintenance of certification modules, a board practice exam, an antimicrobial stewardship curriculum, and additional rotating course offerings, stay current and confident with offerings from the IDSA Academy. Whether you're a seasoned practitioner seeking a comprehensive review or looking to learn something new, earn the credits you deserve. Explore all learning opportunities at idsociety.org/academy.
Great. Well, it's an incredibly frustrating problem in outpatient ID. In particular, this particular study was in younger women, but it's a problem for older women and men, recurrent UTIs, and often with highly drug-resistant organisms. So anything that can prevent recurrence is really, really to be welcomed.
One of the problems is that we don't have enough of these studies, and we don't have them done with studies that are easily available in North America, and the probiotic that you can, you know, most easily get at CVS or Rite Aid or your local store. So we need more of that.
So why aren't more studies like this funded?
Because nobody wants to fund them, because the companies making the probiotic can make just as much money by having a nebulous health claim and selling it without investing all of the money in doing the rigorous studies.
What about our famous NIH?
Well, you know, I've tried to submit a few projects to NIH, and it's quite difficult to get such things funded.
Is it because this falls in between areas of expertise, maybe, or is there some other reason? Or
I think it's just, it's not viewed as rigorous science. I hope the publications like the one you're describing might inspire NIH to look in more detail at these things. There is a whole complementary and alternative medicine arm of NIH, and unfortunately, they don't tend to be focused on this sort of live bacterial product kind of study. You know, it's been my hope that they might move towards this and help doctors and patients make these kind of decisions by focusing on specific probiotics that are available in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, help us look into the future now. We've got 5 to 10 years from now. What is your expectation and or hope for where this field is going? You can talk about specific areas like C. diff or just anything you like.
Well, one of the things that I would really love to have, and I'm sure there's some smart people out there working on it, is a microbiome test for a bad microbiome. A simple stool test that might confirm for us that, oh, this patient with cancer has been excessively treated with antibiotics and they might benefit from something like VOWST before they go into their bone marrow transplant, for example. Greater screening for overgrowth of resistant organisms, again, so we might have a better target for use of therapies like this. Who, after their first episode of C. diff, do we know is likely to recur? So maybe, again, we could target that population. So I think there's a lot to be done on the diagnostic and phenotyping of patients that could be of value. And then, you know, more new products. And there are some companies working on this. I'm hoping to participate in Vedanta, another company in this area, in their phase 3 study for C. diff of a defined consortium. So not derived from stool, no stool involved, all synthetic super probiotics. There's a number of companies internationally that are pursuing that sort of work. And then you can combine it with the prebiotics and, you know, super combinations, fibers or oligosaccharides with microbes, that I think all of these things are going to be happening. Another area where there already is some good work, some of it coming out of Israel, is in metabolic manipulation. You know, with this kind of a microbiome and this sort of a glucose phenotype, advising people regarding diet, microbes, lifestyle changes. And there are already things that you can purchase that allow you to do that. Again, in the pay-by-patient space, not approved by regulators. So I think there's so much potential for these things. And as you know, I'm a cynical, negative person. So the fact that I'm enthused about these things does mean that I think there's a lot of potential here.
Well, I would redefine that, Libby, as a person with high standards.
Well, that does sound better. I'll go with that.
So speaking of high standards, I can't resist getting a consult right now. I've got a patient here with the first episode of C. diff. Your therapeutic recommendation, independent of price?
Oh, absolutely. I would go with fidaxomicin. Narrower spectrum, less likelihood of relapse, same likelihood of cure of the episode. I would give it in the extended dosing paradigm 5 days BID dosing. If they're improved significantly, go to every other day. I would advise them to go to their local store and buy some kefir, get two varieties, figure out which flavor you like. That would be my advice for my own parent if they had a first episode of CFS.
Okay. So that brings us to a pharmacoeconomic issue, which is what on earth happened with the pricing of that drug?
Fidaxomicin?
Yeah. It's crazy.
I know. And, you know, it's not even available. I just saw a patient in clinic this week who couldn't get it on the South Shore of Boston. It varies a lot by site. It varies by plans. You can get it almost all New York plans, pay for it first right off the bat. Here, it's a hassle. So there's lots of variability. It's just crazy. And it's so challenging that the society recommendations are for that as first line. You know, part of the reason they made that was to try to make it more available, and it's not.
Interesting. Okay, and one last consult question. Your dietary spiel that you give to every C. diff patient.
Absolutely. The K foods, kefir, it's a fermented milk drink with multiple different probiotics, unlike yogurts, which typically only have one or two kinds of organisms, comes in many flavors. There's a study out of the University of Minnesota which shows you can cure people who couldn't afford or didn't want fecal transplant by using pulsed vancomycin and kefir. I have colleagues, some of them you know, at Mass General, who used to send me a lot of patients for fecal transplant. They started giving kefir to all their patients, and I don't get those referrals anymore. So it can work. Other fermented foods are kimchi, krauts, live pickles, fermented things. These are all great for the microbiome, and you should eat them.
Okay. Well, Libby, it's been a real pleasure talking with you about this fascinating subject. I want to thank you for joining us. And once again, I've been talking with Dr. Elizabeth Homan. She is a ID specialist at MGH and on the faculty at Harvard Medical School, and she is a specialist in something I'm calling microbiome-related therapies. Thanks, Libby.
Thank you.